Now, last month, the Brisbane Writers' Festival announced it was disinviting Germaine Greer and Bob Carr as speakers for the event. The announcement follows the recent controversy at the Sydney Writers' Festival where Juno Diaz was publicly accused of sexual harassment and pressured to leave the festival. And now, while we may celebrate the freedom of a victim to accuse an attacker, some, including novelist Richard Flanagan, worry whether recent disinvitations are a sign that we're becoming less open to controversial opinions. Now, to discuss the political culture of writers' festivals, I'm joined now by Dr. Lee Boucher, lecturer in modern history at Macquarie University. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Lee.
It's lovely to be with you, Julia.
Great to hear. Now, so we idealise these three types of spaces, you know, open forums, as offering everyone the chance to speak. But do these kinds of spaces really privilege some voices over others, i.e., some men over women or others over LGBTQIA community?
So I think we need to think carefully about the different kinds of spaces we imagine when we talk about something like an open space. So the Writers' Festival is, of course, a curated event. It's not a free and open space. Organisers choose who to put on the platform, so it's already a kind of political choice. It's not like anybody can just get up and speak. But there's also much more implicit kind of, I guess, rules of admission around a lot of the spaces that we might call our kind of open cultures or public cultures or democratic cultures. Certain kinds of voices, certain ways of speaking are less able to make their presence felt in those spaces, I think, historically and still today. And what we've seen with, you know, one way of reading the pushback against Diaz or indeed against Lionel Shriver when she gave her address at the Brisbane Writers' Festival last year, or with Michael Cathcart's interview of Paul Beattie at a Writers' Festival event, where people really pushed back against what these authors were saying or how they were being interviewed in the case of Cathcart and Beattie, is voices that are often marginalised from our public culture, young feminist voices, for example, or racial and gender sexual minorities, using Twitter and social media to offer a kind of counter view to the Writers' Festival, to the kind of discussions going on at the Writers' Festival. And what this, I think, tells us is that that the way these spaces work, the way these open, apparently democratic spaces work, is actually they work to exclude some minority views. And what we've seen in the last couple of years is a real pushback, often propelled through social media, by those excluded voices to try and hold people to account for what they're saying.
Right, and so do you think in this way writers' festivals are indeed becoming political arenas?
I think they were always and already political. Mm. I think they're becoming more controversial. I think their politics is being spoken about much more explicitly, and I think that there's now there's a bit more of a contest. There's visible contests going on when authors speak and say specific kinds of things at writers' festivals, particularly around questions of gender and race and sexuality. When authors make claims around those kinds of categories and what they mean and make claims to be able to speak on behalf of or understand minorities, oftentimes what we've seen is those minorities speaking back actually and saying, actually, you don't understand our experience. It's what you said about us is actually reasonably offensive and sort of holding the authors to account.
Right. Yeah. And so so Richard Flanagan recently wrote for The Guardian that we need to be brave enough to listen to these controversial speakers. Do you agree with Flanagan's view that it's, you know, in a way cowardly not to listen to people like Germaine Greer?
Yeah, look, the position that Flanagan took in that Guardian piece is a pretty well-trodden position, actually. It's a position that, you know, defends basically free speech and he sees any kind of threat to the idea that people can say controversial things. So he sees any threat to the freedom to be controversial as a problem for our democratic culture. That position is premised on the idea that our public culture is free and open for everyone to begin with, which it's not. And secondly, I think Flanagan's position really doesn't take account for the kinds of voices that have been excluded from these spaces and what they're saying. So, you know, the voices that he kind of imagines that there's this chorus of people, I think, who are kind of being imagined by Writers' Festival organisers as mobilising on Twitter to condemn them for what authors say. Now, I don't think that's quite right, but what we can say is that a whole bunch of young feminists have been using social media to pull, to hold male authority to account. And his analysis of the situation just totally ignores that very profoundly gendered question, which I think is part of what's going on here. Of course, you know, there's a kind of call-out culture going on here at the same time. Like, I'm not trying to pretend that Twitter and Facebook are our political saviours and, you know, safe spaces for minorities. They're certainly not. And the kind of call-out culture that's going on in those spaces can be a bit of a problem because there's a kind of pleasure in virtuous condemnation of politically incorrect views, which I think is worth thinking critically about. So I think, you know, he is kind of pointing something out that we need to think about, but he idealises something that was never there, in my kind of opinion.
Right. Well, yeah, as you just kind of spoke about, social media has changed the style of debate, and we are seeing more opinionated voices and maybe hostile ones as well. Do you believe that social media particularly makes debate less nuanced in a way? Or?
Oh, yeah, totally. I think, you know, and I think any analysis where we hold up the possibility for Twitter, for example, to provide a space for political engagement absolutely has to acknowledge the limited capacity of Twitter to cope with nuance. It's a tiny form. When you're limited to that many characters, you can't kind of, you know, you can't engage in kind of political complexity. And I think, you know, we need to see this in the context of the decline, you know, the historical decline over the past decade or two of old newspaper-based kind of journalism as the sort of foundation of our political culture and the rise of these new forms of media. And we're sort of in an interesting transition moment, I think, in that, you know, I'm an historian, and for me, I think we are in a transition moment around some of the places where our democratic engagement occurs. We don't quite know what things are going to look like in 10 years, but the answer to thinking that transformation through isn't to simply say that Twitter is politically polarising and therefore we should just revert to an old idea of the public sphere, because I think that's, I think the bird has flown the coop on that one.
Completely. It's not about the technology, really. It's just how we use it. And,
absolutely.
And that will be interesting to watch throughout the years. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Lee, today.
Absolute pleasure, Julia.
No worries.